are today going to deal with presentation on Medicaid, Medicare, prescription drugs, SB 299, non-discrimination in healthcare providers, and we will take some more testimony on SB 250. Almost undoubtedly not move it today because we had told some folks that we wouldn't because we were, thought we were going to be short of people. But so we'll start with the and present we have Senator Wilkin and myself, Chair Dice. But we'll start with Medicare, the presentation on the overview of Medicare prescription drugs. Who's going to be our presenters? And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Rod Moline. I'm the current director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services. And it's our division that has oversight responsibility for the Medicare Part D prescription drug program. And I have with me our the state CHIP coordinator, Ms. Asin Cotamabia, who is the program coordinator and primary presenter. So I'll turn it over to her.
Please.
Hello, I'm Asin Cotamabia. And I wanted to just give you a brief outline of what we do. And then I was going to just mention about the group that we actually work with. And the technical aspect will be other agencies. Okay. The Senior Care Senior Information Office has the Medicare office that's housed in its division. And we make sure that we have competent Medicare counselors, but they're volunteers. We have 53 of them all over the state. The way we garnered these volunteers was through statewide training. Brought them all into Anchorage, trained them for 3 days with CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services instructors, and also U.S. Administration on Aging instructors. Got them certified, sent them back to their communities so that they can do our face-to-face, especially because of diversity and language. Then we went out and set up what we call enrollment assistant networks. And this is the actual sites where Medicare Part D enrollment takes place. Face-to-face in Anchorage, the wonderful Providence Hospital was nice enough to let us use their facilities for the Anchorage site. And Tuesdays and Saturdays, we have enrollment sites. And it's in other places. We do have a listing here that you can have statewide where they're all located. And also, this listing here is all our volunteers for Medicare. That's year-round on Medicare and any other agency such as TRICARE, VA, Medicaid, as it affects Medicare. So basically, we are the individuals who counsel our Medicare recipients on anything as it has to be to do with Medicare. Those three groups that I want to tell you about real short are individuals who are dual eligible, Medicare and Medicaid. Those individuals we counsel because they're not used to handling all of their health care needs on their own. So while they're learning how to be a little more proactive in their health care life, we walk along with them and guide them. The next group are Medicare recipients who have other health care insurance, TRICARE, VA, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Aetna, also known as Alaska Care for state, for PERS retirees. That group needs to make sure they get a letter from their insurance company saying that Medicare prescription drug plan is equal to, or their plan is equal to, or just as good as. So that's the group with other insurance. The third group is individuals who I'm very concerned with is Medicare only, no other health care insurance. We want to make sure if they have limited income that they also get extra help from Social Security to pay their premiums and their deductibles and their co-insurances. But if their income is not quite limited enough where Social Security can do that, then we want to make sure that they also brought to their attention senior care, which pays for individuals who are 65 and older and pays their deductible and premium for the Medicare Part D. Last group is the Medicare group. The one in the middle was the Medicare with other insurance, and that first group was my dual eligibles, Medicare and Medicaid. These are the groups that we pay attention to, that we make sure they get a face, because Medicare has this program on the computers, technology. We realize with our vast state, and not everyone has a computer, we have to keep that personal touch. So that's what our office does. We keep the personal touch. We give them a live voice. Thank you. Any questions?
No. You're doing good so far. Could I repeat back what I think I heard you say? So you're a head of a state agency that takes these 42 people and trains them on how to address three different groups of Medicare, Medicaid recipients on what's available through the state and federal program.
Yes.
That's your job.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is.
On the record, would you briefly tell me what has happened in the last few years that have changed how Medicaid and Medicare are, what the programs have changed a bit?
Yes.
Give me a little of the history,
yes,
please.
I'm going to give you just a bit of history, then I'm going to bring you to 2 years. For us, Medicare was implemented in 1965, very small health care program for individuals who were 65 years and older. Well, they decided to add prescription drugs. So 40 years, no prescription drugs, wasn't really behaving like a normal health plan as we know. So in 2006, before that, they were saying it's going to begin. So prior to that, dual eligibles were getting their prescription drugs on the Medicaid program, the health care program run by the state. And for Alaska, that's through First Health. That's the contractor. Now those individuals have to get their prescription drugs from Medicare if they happen to be Medicare and Medicaid at the same time. That's a different thing for them because it's a different program, different way of doing things. And there's only a couple of drugs that are excluded by Medicare that Medicaid still takes care of, but it's not many. So the bulk of dual eligible prescription drugs are now being run by Medicare. And that means not just one organization administering it, but private companies. We have 11 prescription drug plans that are contracted to sell their prescription drugs to our Medicare recipients. Of those 11 plans, there are 28 options, something like the gold plan, the silver plan, the platinum plan. So it's really a saver, a medium plan, and then like a premier plan. So 28 options for them to make a choice. Dual eligibles can't make a choice on all of them because the premiums are too high. Medicaid recipients and Medicare recipients can only have premiums at a set level, $34.66. So when you buy a plan, it has to be that level and less. Anything higher than that would be out of their pocket, but we don't let that happen. CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has already enrolled these individuals as of December 31st into a plan, randomly, yes, that took effect on January 1st, 2006. That's the dual eligibles who were placed into a plan. My job is to make sure that we get a hold of anyone that might have been missed by the computer so that we can get them on track and make sure that they don't have a day without prescription drugs. Those who have another health plan, such as TRICARE, VA, Aetna, those individuals also could have been enrolling. And let me back up a moment and say when the enrollment began. November 15th of 2005, the enrollment began, and it goes all the way to May 15th, 2006. This is not the normal enrollment. The normal enrollment will be November 15th through December 31st of each year after this, 45 days. This is just the initial to get everyone in and to help them understand how this program works. So no prescription drug plan prior to January 1st, 2006. We had a little transition program called the discount card. That was going on in the year 2004, began June 1st, and it's still with us only if you happen to not use all of your benefit in 2005, then whatever was left on that little discount card is rolled over into this year, and then it's no longer can be used after May 15, 2006, which happens to be the end of disenrollment. So we had kind of a transition before the big one began this year, 1 January. Any questions on that so far? Okay. Now,
you're telling me more than I want to know.
Oh, let me.
And it's probably what the kind of stuff that dominates your world, but I was looking for more of a 30,000 foot view. We certainly, all of us, get calls to our office, and we see that seniors are having problems figuring out how to make the system work either the way it's supposed to or for them. What do they do to get help?
Actually, I went online. There, the young gentleman there was kind enough to bring up the Medicare.gov website, because this is what we actually do with the customer. They come to our enrollment sites. If they can't, we do this on the phone. As long as they have their red, white, and blue Medicare card, that's the information we need off of the face. So he brought that up for me, and we chose Lipitor as an example. The person needs Lipitor.
Okay. So somebody wants to figure it out, and they can get to a computer terminal and know how to operate it. They can go do a web search and find Medicare.
www.medicare.gov.
Okay, that'll tell them what?
That will tell them, let's go shopping for a plan. Let's go choose a plan that meets your needs for your drugs.
Okay, and they can follow that trail. If they want, from wherever they live, to talk to a living, breathing Homo sapien,
right,
how do they find the phone number that's appropriate for where they live?
Our senior centers throughout the state can go online to get our volunteer list, those names on that list,
okay,
so that they can tell that person, here's someone in Homer who's close to you if you need a live voice.
All right, so option two is they call the closest senior center.
Or a meal site.
Or
a meal site. With several agencies that help our seniors or those in need.
Sorry, so if it's somebody in the bush where there isn't a senior center or a meal service, and how do they look in the phone book or information for somebody that will help them?
They will call the clinic, that clinic that they go to often. And that clinic knows to get a hold of our office or the nearest senior center in the next village. So, for example, I do lots of outreach to update the training on my volunteers to see what's going on in the neighborhood. Places I have not been able to place a volunteer, I go out there and I talk to the elders, tell them who I am, and give them, for their specific area, a contact, so that they can get questions to us. Plus, there's the state hotline. We call back within 24 hours. So they can always call our hotline, even on the weekends.
All right. You want to explain how to use this particular slide rule?
I'm working through it.
It's your federal poverty level. Happens to be 2005. And it'll be changing sometime in by the end of March, April. But right now, that federal poverty level tells an individual that if they're at the 150% federal poverty level and less, they can have extra help from Social Security, which will pay for their premiums, deductibles, and that donut hole you've all heard about. It takes care of all of that, and they tend to have just a copay of $2 for a generic and $5 for brand name. Or if their income is really limited, and it's like maybe 135% federal poverty level, they may have a copay of just $1 for generic and $3 for brand name. Now, if you happen to have over the resources that Social Security puts out, your assets, your boat, your land, things you can turn into cash, then there's the state, senior care. They also do a wraparound, and they go up to not quite the 175% federal poverty level because it's a flat rate. So someone who's single, $20,913 for the whole year, no more than $50,000 in assets, you can get the state while you're in Medicare to pay for your deductible and your premiums, but you must be 65. That's the difference between the state's program and the federal program. Federal helps anyone on Medicare who meets the income levels, but the state helps the individuals at the 65 and older. It's mainly for our seniors, our elders. A couple for the state happens to be $28,053 and no more than $100,000 in assets. So it's really nice if you don't meet the asset income for the Social Security extra help, the state is there for you. So that's kind of what this, in a pictorial form, is talking about.
Any questions, Senator Wilk?
No.
All right, is there anything that you'd like seniors who are listening and watching to know to help them figure their way through this labyrinth?
I want them to call us at our 1-800 number when they're outside of the municipality, and that is 1-800-478-6065. Let me repeat that. 1-800-478-6065. I want them to call with any of their concerns because we're not only a Medicare and senior care office, but we're information and referral. We'll try to get you to a carbon-based life form, someone who will talk to you. Also, when it comes to Medicare prescription drug plan, have your pharmacist print off a nice list of your drugs, your prescription drugs, and the dosage. That's very helpful. And also, bring your red, white, and blue Medicare card. Those two documents are very helpful so that we can get you online, look in the computer to see what Medicare has on you, help you shop for the best plan that meets your needs.
Just a parochial interest, but I don't see any counselors at Chugach Senior Center, Eagle River, Chugach, Peters Creek.
That's correct. We don't have any in that area. My job is to go out and do outreach and recruitment. That's what I do when I go out. Palmer, I went to them recently, and I managed to garner Talkeetna for the Mat-Su area because I'm lacking in that area. So Talkeetna Sunshine is my new community area there, and I will be seeking more.
All right. Thank you, Senator Walker.
Bobby, pull out your wheel there, will you, please? You got your wheel handy?
I don't have mine handy, but I'll.
So if I'm married and I make greater than 20, let's see, my total annual individual drug cost, so let's just say $4,800. So that would be $5,500 a week. And I'm married and have about, and I make greater than $24,045 a year. Is that in Alaska or is that in U.S. dollars?
That's in Alaska.
Alaska dollars.
And that's why the AK is on the bottom, because okay, there are others, Hawaii, lower 48, yes.
So I have a job pays me about $10 an hour, and greater than 24045, but less than 28053?
Yes.
Okay. My estimated annual premium of $386, how do I read that? Plus Yule, $2,900. What is that? How do you read that?
Let me rip that. Cost of money, married?
The number in the window is your share of annual individual drug costs. So I would pay $386 for the insurance, plus $2,900?
They're talking about the premium over the whole year, so 12 months times something to equal that amount would be premiums. Now, we said it's less than the 2853, so that means we're not using the senior care at the moment. They're just talking about it's over Social Security's extra help. But we're in the world where the state could help, but they're not addressing that on this.
Well, so married greater than 24,045, but less than what number?
Less than 28,053.
Okay.
Meaning that the state can help if that person is 65 okay. and older.
And my drug costs are $100 a week, $5,500 a year. What do I pay? Do I pay 386 plus 2,900?
386 would be your premiums, 2,900 over the whole year out of pocket, down from 5,500. You were paying $100.
Oh, so is the 386 12 times, is the 2,900 12 times 386?
No.
No, that's not right.
Premiums are separate from your out-of-pocket for your prescription drugs.
So I write a check to the government for 386.
Or let them take it out of your Social Security check.
Plus, I'm going to pay another 2,900 for drugs that, had I not had this program, I would have paid $5,500 for.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's with no extra help from anyone.
That's just the feds. This is the federal wheel.
Yes.
Okay, and so I'm at 175% of the 05 Alaska federal poverty level. So once I've paid my premium and gotten help from the feds, how does this help us? How does the senior care help me?
They're going to see that you have too much income for extra help from Social Security, the federal. So then you can apply with your senior care application if you're okay. 65 and older, and they're going to know that you already have Medicare, you've already applied for prescription drugs, and they're going to approve you as long as your income is below the maximum for the state and your resources are not above.
Okay. So the exercise we just did is what these 43 people do.
Yes. But I have an easier list for them.
Yeah. Wouldn't want to give us anything that's easy. Okay, well, thank you. That helps me. Helps me understand it.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Does anyone else want to help us on this issue? All right.
Well, thank you. Is the sponsor here for the
299? Got to make a phone call.
All right. I see some folks are here to talk about SB 250. Thank you all.
Thank you.
We'll open the testimony on SB 250. Bill, did you want to talk to us?
Mr. Chairman, I did submit a written comment to through Senator Burr. I don't know if you've received that.
We have. What I understood you to say is that this is this document, Senator Wilkin.
Okay.
You, I think, agree with the conclusion of the auditor about the makeup of the board and don't agree with amendments that were put before us. Is that a fair summary?
Almost. For the record, Bill Tandesky, Commissioner of Public Safety. Mr. Chairman, you're correct. I don't take issue with the finding of an appearance of perhaps conflict in requiring the the network to be consulted, although as a practical matter, I would be inclined to consult anyway. But I also do not oppose the designation of a rural position, which is by practice something that I've advocated for in any case. I did note, however, that I thought the exclusion of some small communities not connected by highway but connected by the marine highway perhaps was overly restrictive. I understand why rural might not, would not mean Ketchikan, Sitka, or Juneau, but should not exclude Pelican or Rangoon or Prince of Wales Island, in my view. So that was my caveat to that. So past that, I think that I think it's really important to have true public members that bring a wide variety of life experience to the council or any board and commission for that matter. And that's the basis of my comments.
Okay. Any questions for Commissioner Tandesky?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to let you go on and do some more valuable things. All right. Bill Hogan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Hogan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. I also submitted a letter to you, Mr. Chair, and also to Senator Terrio. And essentially, I would say that my comments are very similar to Commissioner Tandesky's. We don't think that the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault should have what I would describe as exclusive consultative authority. The system is, frankly, has many stakeholders, including the police, hospitals, other providers, and we think it's important to get information and input from all of them. Again, we agree with there being a designated rural member, but think that the proposed language in the amendment is restrictive. We also think in general that we should not limit the pool of potentially qualified or competent candidates for the council, and our comments, our written comments, reflect that.
So would you say the last sentence again? I tuned you out. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I just simply said that our written comments, or my written comments, reflect the notion that we should not really restrict the potential pool of applicants for the council.
So you agree with the recommendations of the auditor that were put forth in the LBNA bill?
I do, Mr. Chair.
And disagree with the amendments that were put before us?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any questions, Senator? No. All right. Thank you, and thanks for taking the time. Susan Parks? Pardon?
I believe she's out.
Okay. Would you grab her for us? Or Jason will.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Susan Parks. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, and I'm the Department of Law representative on the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I came here today to be available to answer any questions that the committee might have about the bill on the sunset of the council. Do support, of course, extending the council. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, let's see. I'm looking at your paragraph here. I oppose amendment which would exclude state employees as public members. I see. Was that an amendment that was put before us, not the bill, as I remember?
Senator Dyson, I was sent some amendments that my understanding was were, might be proposed, and that was one of them, and was asked to comment on them. I don't know if they're before you right now or not.
It is. All right. Do you have any questions about Susan? Thank you. Thanks for taking your time. Pat, why don't you give us your comments, and then we'll let you go back to doing probably far more valuable things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pat Davidson with the Division of Legislative Audit. After the last meeting and a review of the amendments, I went back and I looked at the series of sunset reviews that we have conducted in the past. What I was looking for were any of the findings and recommendations in those reports have at their core a concern about the composite or the makeup of the council. And I went through, I reviewed them. There were various findings and recommendations, but none of them identified as a core problem the actual composition of the council. And I just wanted to let the committee know that I did go back and look at that.
So what's the implication of that? What did that say to you? Nobody else saw a conflict of interest before?
Mr. Chairman, it's looking at the amendments that were being discussed at the last meeting.
Yes.
It seemed to address who was on the council. And what I did is I went back and I said, well, have we had any problems in the past with regard to who was appointed to the council or their qualifications to sit on the council, given what the old rules were? And what I found is, no, we didn't have any problems with the composition of the council as it currently exists.
All right. All right. Any questions for Pat? All right. Thank you. And for the record, Senator Elton joined us about 5 minutes after 2. Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing the bill again. I'm Tom Maher with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. You asked me to check with Senator Terrio on the amendment, which I've done. He's also reviewed the departmental responses. And from the LBNA committee perspective, what the LBNA committee did, of course, is eliminate the reference to the network. Originally, Senator Terrio was quite supportive of putting back in statute a network member on the council as an ex officio non-voting member. I can tell you that after reviewing the departmental responses, he feels much less strongly about doing that because the departments were very opposed to that and indicated it would be a conflict, too. So that's what I got from the chairman.
Right. And for the record, Senator Olson joined us about 7 minutes after the hour.
Mr. Chairman, in general, he does not support a complete rewrite of council composure here. So that's what I got.
All right. Thank you. Peggy Brown?
Good afternoon. I'm Peggy Brown, the Executive Director for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I wanted to address a couple of these issues and shed some light on what this is about. First of all, we support the extension of the council in its entirety. And just to let you know, we were kind of asked to come up with some language and criteria to address the removal of the network from the legislation. However, we would be more than happy to work with somebody or to let the council take that over and provide that criteria. We were merely responding to a request. Second, just to let you know, I don't know if you've seen this, but this is a letter that was written to Pat Davidson by the chair of the council that basically says that they, in recommendation number 2, The council recognizes and understands the merit of this issue. It's important to note the governor is not bound by any recommendation by the network. Because of this safeguard, the council believes that obtaining input from the network, which has significant knowledge and expertise, outweighs any limitations or theoretical conflicts. You know, in late 1978, the network formed, and in late 1981, the council was formed at the behest of the network because they saw the need for there to be a state agency that had pass-through capabilities for funding. The network has been around for many years, and I wanted to speak to the fact that the reason that we came up with these items in the amendments, because they're things we already do. The council does invite the director of the network to attend meetings, to be a part of the process. You know, we work closely together. The idea behind having the director of the network be an ex officio member, quite frankly, is to provide an institutional knowledge to the council members. You know, except for one of them, Department of Education, they have changed with various administrations. And I think we all know that the council staff, the council directors, have changed repeatedly in the last 10 years. The network has been around for a long time. I have been at the network for 10 years myself. We have the level of expertise and we have the level of knowledge, not only what's going on with the programs across the state that provide direct services, but we work with the Governor's Council on Disabilities. We work with OCS. We work with public assistance. We're very tied into other state systems. Being an ex officio member, I do not believe is a conflict. I believe it would be an asset. It provides that stability. It provides a knowledge of what's going on with domestic violence and sexual assault across the state and what's being done in addition to just funding the programs and making sure that they're viable and whole in their service provision. So it just formalizes, I think, what already happens and makes sure that there's continuity. Second, I mean, we are the experts. I mean, a lot of us, I have background in law enforcement and medicine. Many other people in the field have various degrees. We have healthcare providers who are public members. We have business members. We have taken it upon ourselves to be at the service of the governor. It's not that we are requesting that he listen to us or the administration. It's a matter of, if you would like qualified people to serve on your council in a public member capacity, we're the people who are going to know that. We're going to know that Ann House is a public member and she's a private business person, but she has a certain level of expertise in domestic violence and sexual assault. We know that she's not a perpetrator. So in a way, it's we provided this service that is more of a screening process. And Lorraine Durer, the former with Boards and Commissions, would call me and say, do you have a recommendation for a public member? And we would get on it, and we would work as a group to see who would be willing to serve, see who was in a rural area, see who was off the road system. The Commissioner of Public Safety himself, as you've heard him say, has even called me and said, you know, we need a little more rural perspective. We're kind of Anchorage heavy. We're kind of state employee heavy. So really all we have done is provided that service. As to designating a member to be a survivor or an advocate, you know, when we looked at coming up this language, quite frankly, we just looked at all the other boards that the Council Commission on Aging, the Board of Governors, the Alaska Children's Trust Board, and some of them denote, like the Alaska Mental Health Trust, you know, one public member should be a mental health service provider. That's really all we did, is trying to come up with the best composite of what public members should look like. In terms of ex officio, again, that has just to be a consultant and provide some consistency. We have no interest in the director being able to vote. I see that as a direct conflict of interest because, you know, at a funding meeting, that would particularly be a conflict of interest. However, you know, one thing that you should know is that the council doesn't necessarily meet with the programs. The only time they directly hear from the programs is during a funding meeting. And I think there are larger issues going on around the state with domestic violence and sexual assault other than funding. And so that was the purpose of ex officios. The addition of the state worker, I can tell you, quite frankly, that is something that I personally have a little bit of trouble with myself. There's currently a state worker on the council who serves in the capacity of public safety. She is a public member, and she's a great council member. She's very knowledgeable. She provides a lot of expertise. So I would be happy to work with anybody on that part of the amendment. Really, it was just put in there because it was just trying to address any potential conflicts on the council. So what we have done, in summary, is we've just tried to clean things up and put down what we actually do and what things would be helpful and how things should look. If the council would like to come up with its own criteria, I would be happy to work with them to do that.
Thank you. Any, Senator Elton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Apologies. Other member and I were late because we were in another meeting, so I may have missed a little bit that may have been pertinent. But Peggy, I was just given before the meeting a copy of the Department of Public Safety's response to the amendments, and would appreciate your point of view. I mean, should we be taking this as the position of the council, or should we be taking this as a position of one member of the council?
Well, I think that's a good question because you have, you know, four commissioners, and you're talking about Commissioner Tandeski's. You know, he represents a council member, a voting council member. He also represents his department. But in answer to your question, Senator Elton, I think that that is something you would have to ask him.
Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at some of the amendments that have come forth, I guess, what are your feelings on the three amendments that have been drawn to our attention?
I think that the network should remain in as at the service of the governor and the administration for recommending public members. The amendments, I think, the director of the network should be an ex officio member for the reasons that I have stated. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons that you wouldn't normally know and you wouldn't normally see unless you were actually in that process of the council. The council is a state funder. The network is the state coalition. So I would support that for the reasons I stated. I would definitely support that public members have a public member face. And it's very important, particularly in funding meetings, we have them in June, that those members, they're voting and they're moving funds around to the various programs. And if a rural representative is not on that body, I think it has an appearance of impropriety and bias between rural and urban. I also think having a survivor, I'm a little surprised by some of the comments, actually, that someone would actually say, well, that's too restrictive to have a victim or a survivor as a public member. This is what we're doing. We're providing services to domestic violence and sexual assault victims. You know, mental health board requires that somebody, you know, who's had worked with mental health and has had some mental health issues in their life be on that board. If we want that board to look like the people that we serve and the people who are willing to serve those victims, I think you should have some some definite mandates.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could just be more specific, you are not opposing, or you are opposing, the amendment that has the two public members, one being a survivor and one being an expert in the field?
I am not opposing that. I am very much in favor of
thank
that.
You, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any more questions? Thank you. And thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
Maybe when you have time, I'd enjoy some time to talk to you personally.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Barbara Mason?
My name is Barbara Mason. I'm the Executive Director of the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'd like to thank the Senate Hess Committee for hearing Senate Bill 250. And also, I'd like to say that I contacted all of the council members prior to doing any testimony, which I didn't have a chance to do last Friday, so I could get a feel for what people thought. So many of my comments are a synopsis of what the other council members had told me when I contacted them. Most of the council members asked a number of things, is what is the purpose of the amendment? They didn't know what was the situation that it was trying to fix. Is there a problem? Has there been a problem? So that was the very first question that almost every single one of them asked. And they also wanted to know is, would this amendment create any problems? What would be some of the issues that it might create? For example, it would remove from consideration over 14,000 public employees that are Alaskan residents that have expertise in this field of sexual assault and domestic violence. It could also remove the possibility of getting a concerned public members who have valuable expertise in areas such as child support enforcement, which is where a current public member was working when they were put on the board, assigned to the board on their appointment. And also there's some inconsistencies with the public employment piece as well in differentiating between government employees between the municipalities, the boroughs, the cities, tribal. Those kinds of entities. So are we talking, how are we defining state employee for that particular piece of it? In specific, the council supports extending extending the review date of the sunset audit to 2014. And it supports, and it does not oppose having one public member being a member from rural Alaska, but agrees with all of them brought up the issue about the Marine Highway issue, and let's keep that open because there are small communities out that is accessible by Marine Highway, but they are still considered very rural. They do oppose restricting the selection of the other two public members for several reasons. One of the issues that was brought up is how do you define an expert in this field? There are no university or college degrees in domestic violence, sexual assault. So how would you define an expert? Would it be so what would be the criteria used to designate a person as an expert? This is a relatively new field, and many of the individuals who gain expertise work in this field. Many of those who have worked with and are considered experts have become interested in domestic violence and sexual assault because of their professional contact with this population. They expand their knowledge by reading, they attend conferences, they go to classes. They review the research in order to expand their knowledge and become experts. And these experts come from a wide variety of professions, including faith leaders, therapists, health profession, lawyers, prosecutors, and many others. There are no standard qualifications to identify them as such. The amendment specifies that one member shall be a survivor or a victim, advocate, and an expert in the DVSA service program delivery. Section 6C states that a person who receives compensation from or is an employee of a domestic violence or sexual assault or crisis intervention or prevention program may not be an appointed. The section asking for that the person be either a survivor or a victim advocate or having worked with pretty much limits that pool to either those that have retired from the field or taking some other job, so it would limit the actual pool of being able to identify that individual or an individual that would be eligible for the board, for the council. And, you know, then there's this whole issue of just keeping the members open because we need the greatest pool we can to pull from as many professions as we can for that expertise. The council also opposed having the executive director of the network as an ex officio member of the council. And it's not because we don't have a tremendous amount of respect. We have a great deal of admiration and respect for the network and the work that they do. I personally, having been here just a year, have been very much helped by the network members and have established relationships. I hope good relationships with them. I feel so. But the network is composed of the programs that we fund. And they also receive funding from us, the network does. They receive two grants. One is a VAWA grant that's for victims that the network receives directly, and they also received a discretionary grant. So you have two issues there. They also, the programs pay the network to represent them and to lobby for them. So we feel that that's just way too strong of a conflict. We like the relationship that we have. We like being able to rely on them, and the council does. They have them on the agenda at each meeting. They will ask them for their expertise and opinion because they do respect their opinion. And the meetings are open to everyone, including any of the programs that feel that they would like to participate or be involved in. So that it's not a closed meeting. They're all public meetings. So we feel like if the programs feel like they would like to have more of an input, they're more than welcome to participate in the public meetings that are held quarterly by the council. As probably you can tell by the previous statements, we oppose having not allowing state employees to be public members. State employees come to the state with a variety of personal experiences in their private life as well as from their employment history, which could include expertise in this field, both in their private and professional lives. State employees, because of their employment, also develop expertise in this field. Child welfare workers work closely with this population, and many, because of their contact with them, will do a tremendous amount so that they gain expertise. In the field of domestic violence, when you look at how victims and offenders get services, they will have contact with people like law enforcement as first responders, medical EMS people. They will have OCS, prosecution, legal advocates, courts, including tribal courts. They will have judges, housing authority, batterers programs, treatment programs, probation and parole, jail, prison. You know, okay, I won't list them all. but what I'm trying to say with that is a number of these are government employees, and they're state employees. And to limit the pool, you know, we only have three public members to only that portion that is not employed by the state, I think is very limiting, and so does my board. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Hang on. Are there questions for Barbara? Senator Elton?
I do, and Barbara, thanks for your testimony. I mean, we now have four state employees that are designated to be on the council. So a majority of the people already are state employees, and that's by statute. And I mean, as you can maybe tell, I mean, my predilection is if you have a majority of the people who are already state employees, I mean, why would you want to add another state employee? It would seem to me that if you have three public employees, why not look at the municipalities? Why not look at the nonprofit service providers? Why not look at all of these other people so that you don't have even more of a preponderance of state employees? I guess I don't understand the argument that you have designated seats for state employees. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you want less than half of them to come from outside of state government?
And to me, what it is that this field encompasses more than the private nonprofit as well, and they're very well represented by the network, as I said, that has been included. But when you're looking at the commissioners and some of their designees, they may not have the same expertise as a child welfare worker, a trooper, a medical emergency person, or those people that have their personal street expertise in terms of dealing with this position or dealing with this issue. So if you limit it to just those that are advocates for the victim portion, where then is also the expertise in dealing with how do we deal with offenders? I come from a system that had representation from all of those in both the government council as well as the community-based council, and I found that worked better. It allowed for a much more open process of looking at the different perspectives that each profession brings to this field.
Well, Mr. Chair and Barbara, I don't want to sound like I'm badgering you.
Okay.
And I apologize if I do sound like I am. But you have four designated seats, four specific commissioners or their designees that are a part of a seven-member council.
Yeah.
The amendment that I propose doesn't say, it says, you know, no other state employees. I mean, it doesn't limit it then to nonprofits. Mm-hmm. It doesn't limit it to medical profession. It just says that whoever the other three members are, they won't be the fifth state member.
Mm-hmm.
We now have a business person on, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem fair to me to say, well, we're limiting, you know, 14,000 people, we're keeping them away from the table. I mean, we're not. We've already guaranteed them a majority of seats at the table.
Well, the purpose of the council in some ways is to address some of the government state entities that address domestic violence issues. So, and again, many of our members in the past, where there hasn't been issues, have come from state employment. We had somebody who worked for the Permanent Fund Dividend as the prior chair. We've had others that have worked as state employees, and they have brought valuable experience from a victim advocacy perspective, from a personal perspective as having been a prior victim. I understand that one of the members as a state employee had. So we feel like we can cover that. If you have a state employee that is also has worked as an advocate, has been a victim, and has expertise, does that mean that person would not be eligible to be on the board? What we feel like is that we're limiting that selection. It's like, no, we can't have these folks on here because they're precluded because they're a state employee, even if they would meet the other criteria.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This is a glass half full, glass half empty kind of a thing.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that it's more full for the state employees right now than it is
right. Yeah, we're not going to move on this bill today, and you may want to continue this conversation. And Senator Elton, if you choose to modify any of your amendments, you know, between now and when we hear it again, probably on Monday, please let us know.
Mr. Chair, I'll commit to making some modifications.
I suspected you would.
Yeah.
And how soon will we be able to get the members who weren't here a written copy of today's testimony? How soon does that happen?
You can do it immediately.
Pardon?
You can do it right away.
Well, I just want to make sure that they have it available so that testimony. Thank you. I thought your testimony was remarkably cogent.
Thank you.
And all too rare.
By the end of the week.
Okay. All right. So I want to be able to move on this. And we should have a full committee. And so we'll lay this bill aside, and we'll take up the any willing provider legislation of Senator Seekins. Thank you all for coming. Hopefully you won't be required to come back.
At ease.
Yeah, brief at ease. Back on the record, Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have before you Senate Bill 299, which is an act relating to preventing unfair discrimination against a health care provider who is willing to meet a health insurer's terms and conditions for participation in the insurer's plan, policy, or contract for health care services. It amends the definition of provider as it relates to authorized collective negotiations by physicians affecting the rights of providers under health benefit plans. Alaska Statute 2136090D pertains to unfair discrimination against a person who provides services covered under a group health insurance plan. This law comes into play as a function of the relationship between health care providers and group health care systems. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Kentucky's Any Willing Provider, or what we'd call AWP law. The language used in this law essentially offers a more robust alternative to Alaska's current law. Senate Bill 299 repeals AS 2136-09D and replaces it with case-tested AWP language, and the move towards AWP verbiage also required a change in the definition of health care provider. And in so doing, the original definition as it's used in Title 23, Labor and Workers' Compensation, had to be restored. This can be found in Section 2 of the bill. Essentially, the AWC concept promotes the individual's ability to choose his or her own health care provider rather than have this decision be directed via a process far removed from the point of contact. The AWP law says that a health care insurer cannot discriminate against any provider who is willing to meet the terms and conditions for participation established by the health insurer, assuming the provider is located within the geographic coverage area of the health benefit plan. The AWP issue is especially pertinent in cases where, for example, a woman in her second trimester of pregnancy changes jobs, and in this instance, she may also be forced to change health care providers if her current provider is not recognized by her new health insurance plan. This same scenario also applies in cases where a person takes a job, but the pool of physicians offered by the employer's health care plan does not include the individual's longtime family doctor. In both cases, if the patient's non-network physician is willing to accept the network fee schedule and meets the insurance company's licensing and credentialing standards, the patient should be able to continue to see their own and trusted doctor rather than be forced to establish a relationship with a new and unknown physician. Senate Bill 299 adopts into Alaska law the Any Willing Provider concept, thereby promoting and preserving Alaskans' ability to make their own choices with respect to health care providers. We have a number of experts here to testify to you today that will be able to give you some good examples of how this would be carried out and some of the challenges that would be solved, and I would appreciate your allowing them to be here to testify with you today, Mr. Chairman, and glad to answer any questions.
The questions for Senator Seekins. Senator Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Seekins, we're dealing with version A alpha, and I just wanted to know, it's not listed, what is the referral track?
The referral track?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Explain to me what you think.
What committees is it referred to?
Oh, a referral track. Brian? Labor and Commerce, I think.
Hess and, is this the first committee of referral?
Yes.
So Hess, Labor and Commerce?
Yes.
Okay, no finance referral?
Not that I'm aware of at this point.
Okay, thank you.
No fiscal note that I'm aware of.
Okay. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You made a comment earlier on that the language in this bill had to do with case-tested language, I think was the word you used.
Yes.
And what particular were they talking about there?
The U.S. Supreme Court case in Kentucky on any willing provider. So
what went to the U.S. Supreme Court and
it was upheld.
Upheld there.
Yes. So we basically shadowed that language.
Mr. Chairman, if I can continue, how does this affect some of the 638 contractors out in rural Alaska?
Sir, I don't know what a 638 contractor is, but I'll bet my experts do.
Okay. And it's actually one of the, it's on the public law 638, which is the health corporations that are out in Bush, Alaska that are getting federal funds for this?
I'm not sure. I couldn't answer that. Not being a physician, you're probably more familiar with that than I am, but I bet we can provide that answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. What order would you like to put your experts on?
Which order?
I'd like to ask Dr. Rainier to be first, Mr. Chairman.
All right. How are you, sir?
Bison, Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, sir.
Elkin and Senator Elkin.
Nice to see you.
I'm George Rainier, a cardiologist from Anchorage. I've been in practice for 35 years in Alaska.
You need to set the record clear. Where do you live?
I live in Eagle River, Alaska.
Thank you, sir.
Proud resident of Eagle River. And I'm here today talking for the Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, which is a physician group in South Central Alaska, who in this case is representing the population of Alaska, its patients. So here I am talking to you as an advocate for patients. Now, I think every one of you, if you were to ask your constituents if they were in favor of this bill, you'd have a universal answer of yes. I certainly have talked to every patient that I can think of, and virtually, and many people in business also feel exactly the same way. And it's not surprising, because what this bill does is provide for freedom of choice. Now, Alaskans and Americans are thrilled with the idea of freedom of choice. And right now, we do not have that clearly in Alaska. There are patients of mine who I prefer to refer to a certain endocrinologist. The patients cannot see them because they are penalized economically and quite severely by the insurance company through which they have insurance, because this particular endocrinologist is not on their panel, although he'd be perfectly willing to see them. But the patients cannot afford to do so because of the severe economic repercussions. I've had patients from areas outside of the state who do not have an enabling provider law, who have been through four cardiologists in the preceding, that is, four groups of cardiologists in the preceding 2 years, because of changes in jobs, changes in contracts with their companies. And these patients, many of them had very severe chronic life-threatening illnesses, which truly were not benefited by switching physicians every 6 months or so. Not having the freedom to choose your own physician is counter-therapeutic, really. I mean, do you want to see a patient, or do you want to see a physician whom you don't trust, don't know, maybe don't know anything about? Do you want to have to see that person because of some economic tie that your insurance company has with other physicians? I think not one of you would feel comfortable in doing that. If you were to see that person and you're not comfortable with them, maybe you didn't like them, who knows what the trust level is, that is not therapeutic. Everybody knows that for best outcomes in illness, where we always have limited resources and limited abilities despite what appears to be magical talents, it's very important that the patient trusts his physician, honors his physician, and wishes to do what his physician thinks best. So it's counter-therapeutic not to be able to have freedom of choice in medicine. It's not like buying tires. It's not like, you know, using a different airline. Although in some cases, maybe trusting an airline is not a bad thing either. So, and lastly, in this state, when an insurance company can make or break you as a physician by either selecting or deselecting you to be on their panel, it makes it somewhat extra difficult for us to recruit physicians to come to this state when, after they get here, get in business, develop a cadre or a panel of patients they see, have the insurance company threaten them with deselection unless they kowtow to a onerous economic relationship. So I think there are hands down innumerable good reasons for having this bill. No serious ones against it. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Sir, what's the relationship between the Alaska Physicians and Surgeons Group and the Alaska Medical Association?
The Alaska Medical Association is a professional organization and is partnership with the American Medical Association. The Alaska Physicians and Surgeons was started about 6 or 7 years ago as more of a business and legislative group. They are separate organizations, although many of the members of one belong to the other.
We have been given some documentation that says that passing this law will drive costs up. As I understand and have read the law, it says that whoever the provider is must agree to the fee schedule that is offered by the whoever the third-party payer is. Is that your understanding of what we're doing?
That is exactly my understanding.
All right. Then there was part of your testimony then that I didn't understand because you, I thought I heard you say that doctors would have to agree to an onerous remuneration or schedule or something. Would you clarify that for me?
Yes, yes. When an insurance company has a large share of the business in a community, and the insurance company then can direct its patients from one group of physicians to another by having them in their panel or not, then if you have, as a physician, a group of insurance patients, and the insurance company wishes to reduce your income, that is, your payments by one half, for instance, which would basically be less than your overhead, it's very difficult for you to refuse that as a physician if you understand that the alternative is for that insurance company to take all those patients and give them to some other physician.
Okay,
that's how that works.
I'm going to try to apply my reflective listening skills here. So an insurance company or another third-party payer represents several thousand client patients, and they go to some medical providers and say, hey, we'll deliver all these patients, but the deal is you got to knock 30% off the cost. All right. And so if they get a group discount, volume discount for that. Now, if one of those patients decides that they want to stick to their own family doctor, maybe it's you, and they come to you, then if in order for them to be treated by you and paid by the same third-party payer, you'd have to agree, as I understand this law, to that discount schedule that had been that the third-party payer agreed to. Have I got it right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right.
Right. At the present time, that does not exist.
Yeah. All right. Right. I got that.
Right. And the in larger communities, New York City, Chicago, maybe even San Francisco, where you have thousands and thousands of physician groups and tens or hundreds of hospitals, it's more easy to defend that kind of predatory activity on the part of an insurance company than in a community where you may have two groups of urologists, two groups of cardiologists, this two hospitals, etc.
I got it. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions for Dr. Rainier? Senator Elton?
You almost called me doctor, didn't you? I never worked that hard in school, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I appreciate your testimony, and I mean you. And maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I was thinking of this as employers and not insurance groups, and it seems to me that one of the outcomes of this could be that if, in fact, the employer through whatever group they have. Can't negotiate a price break on the provision of health care, that two things can happen. Either that employer's health care costs go up or changes are made to the health care benefits that the employee has. And so can you speak to the issue on whether or not any willing provider can change the dynamic between the employer and the employee and the amount of health care coverage that they might have?
It's in other jurisdictions, there has been no apparent change in the cost to companies or the providers of insurance through their premiums when any willing provider laws have been established. So it would appear from observations and measurements that this does not have any deleterious effect on that relationship.
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in just a follow-up, Doctor, if you could. I'd be interested in those observations that you cite, because the other side has cited observations that point to exactly the opposite.
I understand.
So anything you can provide would be helpful.
If I might make one more comment about that particular issue. In Alaska, virtually all of the money which is spent on health care remains in Alaska. And it goes towards improving care, it goes towards machinery, it goes towards greater availability of nurses, it goes towards modernization of health care in Alaska. Very little of it goes someplace else to shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. It all, virtually all, stays here. So when people talk about money being saved elsewhere, and you certainly have heard many, many stories of your in your own experience of people that you've known in the lower 48 who have been in the hospital and who couldn't find a nurse, who've had to wait excessive lengths of time for their service. Managed care has had a very serious effect on the availability and probably the quality of health care delivered elsewhere. We want to try to avoid getting pinched in ways which actually interfere with the performance and the delivery of good health care here. The money stays here.
Data would be helpful, Mr.
Yep. All right. And I want to make sure that people, particularly that have traveled and would have difficulty testifying in another meeting, get another chance. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for helping us.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Go ahead, Mr.
Oh.
Actually, I have a question for Dr. Rainier, if I could.
Go ahead.
Dr. Rainier, thank you very much for coming down this afternoon. I know you have a busy schedule and appreciate your appearing in front of this committee. You know, as we look, I guess I found it somewhat interesting, the last question that was asked by Senator Elton, that in your comment was that the money stays here in Alaska. I'm sure you will remember the days that, and I was still a medical student back then, I have to admit that when Mr. Kamuza, who was part of the Sisters of Providence, had built up a pretty good-looking hospital out there in Anchorage before the Teamsters Hospital came along and was doing well. But I was under the impression that the money that was there with Providence went back to the main offices there in Oregon, and that helped to go ahead and make sure that other ventures for health care delivery were put into place. Is that not the case?
Well, I have certainly heard that rumor in the past, and I've heard that rumor at the present time. However, I am on the board of Providence, Alaska, and every month we get a rundown of the finances of the hospital, what the expenses, income have been, etc. Mm-hmm. And I have never seen any evidence that there is money transferred to the Seattle office, because the Seattle office is an owner. The corporation does require that for the services that it provides to the local hospitals, they are remunerated for that. The outsourcing, the billing, for instance, is done in Seattle. Money goes to Seattle for that particular kind of issue. But and you could ask the people from Providence this, but the majority of the money that's called margin is used for capital improvements, and I can assure you that.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I've got one other concern that I have with the scenario that you put forth. One of the concerns that I have is small business people that are out there that are providing, at least most small businesses don't even have the ability to go and provide any kind of health insurance or any kind of coverage for that. And the smaller, and the ones that are providing it, they're having difficulty just trying to keep up with the high cost of the health care delivery system that is out there, as well as the health professionals, of which obviously both you and I are a part of that. How do we make sure that those small business people are able to continue to provide health care for its employees?
I think that's a far more elaborate, there's a far more elaborate answer to that than I could possibly begin to talk about now. I think this, from observations, plays a very small part in that issue.
But doesn't this bill work against that?
There's no evidence that it does.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Who's the next person you want?
Would be Mr. Mike Jordan, Mr. Chairman. And I think the answer to your question about the whether or not your physician has to accept that fee is correct, but you get to go and say, will you do this for me? It's not that you have to accept the entire panel of people that they send to that physician.
Senator Wilkerson?
Senator Seekins, maybe the doctor, or last week I had a conversation with one of our administrators at one of our big clinics in Fairbanks. He had some rather sobering data about the doctor-to-patient ratio in Fairbanks and to extend to that to Alaska. Does this legislation help or does it detract from us in encouraging physicians to come to Alaska?
Yeah. My opinion, Senator, through the chair, is that it will help. Again, I think the rationale that Dr. Reiner laid out there was that you don't have a large block of people that are particularly tied up to one particular clinic or one particular group, that your patients, regardless of their health care plan, would be able to negotiate with you to be able to provide coverage. And I think that it expands the universe of available physicians. Now, that's my opinion. If I'm wrong, maybe Mike can tell you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. My name is Mike Hogan. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons. It's a 170-doctor physician group in Anchorage. I'm here really to strong support SB 299 and thank the Senator for sponsoring it. To answer your question, Senator Wilkins, through the chair, it's our contention, we've been working with other healthcare entities that trying to create the most favorable environment we possibly can in Alaska to attract new physicians is one of our chief goals. And we've had a series of legislation that is trying to, over the past few years, it's tried to address pieces of this. We think this is another one. One of the criteria that, as Dr. Reiner mentioned, that new doctors looking at the state of Alaska will look at is what sort of relationship am I likely to have with the insurance carriers in the state? And what sort of leverage are they like to have, likely to have over me? Now that the Supreme Court has cleared the idea of any willing provider and the ERISA preemption that was at issue, I think you're going to see more and more of these types of pieces of legislation in states across the country. And we need to do everything we can to try to attract new doctors. That's one of our chief missions. And if they know that, even if they're not currently in a panel, they've got an established relationship with their patients, they can go to an insurance company and say, look, I'm willing to abide by your terms. I am fully licensed. I'm qualified. I'll meet your credentialing requirements. Give me the packet and I'll sign it. That, I think, is good for the patient, and it's good, quite frankly, to attract new physicians to the state as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Rupp?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kind of the same question, Doctor. I think I understand, you know, your argument that it is good for the patients, but there is an element that we're not talking about, and that is the ability of employers, large numbers of people, to negotiate health care costs that also are beneficial to the patient. I mean, lower health care costs means that likely they're either paying less or they have more health benefits. And I'd like to have you talk to that issue, because I mean, it just seems like common sense that if you have any willing provider, there is going to be less of an incentive for any health care provider to negotiate a fairly significant break for the employer and thus for the employee.
I think that model, you're talking about group discounts or steerage is, I guess, the term that's used, really works much better in states that actually have an overabundance of physicians. In this state, it's been calculated, I think, by the State Medical Association that we are roughly 400 physicians short out of a private physician population of about 1,200. So you can see it's a fairly significant percentage. If an insurance plan really can't, some of them other than Blue Cross have had trouble establishing significant panels in this state.
It's our contention that because they can't guarantee steerage in the sense that you're talking about, well, I'm a little bit confused here. Could you help me out? Rephrase the question.
I mean, I think I understand, you know, the benefit of somebody being able to say, well, I want to go to my previous doctor, or I want to change doctors. And I understand that benefit. But it seems to me that one of the things that is the flip side of that is it reduces the ability of an employer or the employer's insurance company to negotiate rates that are lower, which would have the beneficial impact on patients, or patients that are covered anyway, would have the beneficial impact of either lower health care costs or a broader recipe of health care options. Because if you negotiate a price that's 25% less, it may mean that your health care plan isn't cut, or that the costs for your health care plan don't go up. And that seems to be a beneficial side to the flip side of this legislation.
Well, we do have information from the state of Kentucky that's looked at this issue over the last 10 years and cost, and we can provide that to you. And it's the state's contention, at least the information we have, that it has not significantly affected cost. The argument can be made. I think that you're going to have to weigh that as part of your deliberations. But we do feel strongly that in the end, the focus should be on the patient and the patient's ability to choose the physician or the healthcare provider that they want to see and stick with that provider.
Thanks. And Mr. Chair, just the same request. If you've got that information from Kentucky, it would be great if you could provide it.
Okay.
I might add, Senator Elton, that negotiating lower prices for a group of employees also works against the last few Americans who think that taking care of their health is their own responsibility and pay their own bills. You know, they get to pay 100%, and they get to pay some offset for those that get a discount. And you can argue about which is the greater good. I happen to have a great affinity for people that accept the responsibility of paying their own bills. Who else do you want, Senator?
That's it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Hogan, if you could just tell me what this bill is, if it does indeed have an effect on, you're familiar with the 638 contractors out there that are mainly dealing with the health corporations, and even South Central Foundation is another 638 contractor there in Anchorage as well.
I'm going to have to get back to you with an answer on that. Okay. I'm going to have to familiarize myself with that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for helping us. Tom, I assume you're going to be around next week?
Yeah.
Okay.
Except Wednesday.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. We've got three people in Anchorage and two off net. Any of you have some time constraints and wouldn't be available to speak to us next Wednesday?
Yes, actually two of us are going to be out of town next Wednesday.
I'm sorry, who's that?
This is Greg Hudson in the Anchorage LIO office. Two of us that are here will not be in town next Wednesday.
All right, then please go ahead and give us your testimony now and try to limit it to 3 minutes if you can.
Okay. We're here to speak against the bill, and we actually prepared some, I'm getting some feedback on this side. I don't know if it's possible to turn down the volume. Thanks. Cost containment to Biglot with Willis, I'm a healthcare consultant to represent a lot of self-insured trusts and large employers in the state of Alaska. Cost containment is a broad term that we use for a toolbox of methods to reduce healthcare costs for health plans. Contracting with a select group of providers is one of the best methods that we have for limiting costs. We can't expect discounts from providers without offering them direct healthcare dollars in exchange. An example would be if you happen to sell cars, if you are asked for a discount from a large purchaser, if you're the exclusive provider, I'm going to give a better discount than if you are just one, any option that's on the market. You might get down to a much closer, much smaller profit margin that's built into that cost. Contracting is also key to offering and using other cost containment methods. Quality of the provider and ongoing care is addressed during the credentialing process. It's not just a matter of price. When a PPO or an insurer or a healthcare selects a PANTS for trust contract, we hire credentialing businesses that go in and check the background, the experience, and any complaints against providers. Health plan members know that there's been a basic level of quality assurance done on the providers offered to them. They can still choose providers outside of the contract, but at a lower reimbursement level. So we do not limit choice of members of our health plans to only those groups or providers that we've contracted with. Consumer-driven health plans, which include health savings accounts and health reimbursement arrangements, are also dependent on getting good data, including price and quality data. And it's something that we see as being the future of healthcare, but by contracting with a group of providers, it's not just the prices that they charge, but we also get good data from them on what they provide and have price information to give out to our customers, the people that are covered by our health plans. Disease management programs are another way that we use to contain costs and actually work with the contracted providers to try to improve the quality of care and to decrease the extent of time people spend in hospitals or other high-cost treatment options. I'll limit my testimony now.
All right. Thank you, sir. Are there questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions I have for you is the last thing, at least a medical student or just a new physician that's just been licensed wants to come into is a situation where he's under some type of managed care. How do we make sure that HMOs don't become a predominant conveyor of health care here in Alaska?
Well, we don't have HMOs in Alaska.
I understand that, and we want to make sure they don't necessarily get a strong foothold here.
I don't see how this bill is going to prevent that. I mean, if my understanding right now is the reason we don't have HMOs, we require any group of providers that want to take risk to file as an insurance company. There's a lot of other issues they have to jump through rather than just this contracting issue that this bill addresses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Colleen?
Yes.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Okay, thank you. My name is Colleen Savoy. I'm with Willis of Alaska as well. And as Greg said, we represent a number of both insured plans and large health funded entities. Our opposition to Senate Bill 299 is that it would result in increased medical costs. I'm not going to repeat Greg's previous testimony, but I do want to point out a couple of things. The first thing is just to emphasize that employers are really struggling with the increased cost of health care. And the fact of the matter is they are having to either reduce benefits or increase employee contribution rates or employee cost sharing, or they're having to eliminate coverage altogether. Using PPO networks, preferred provider networks, has been very successful so far in helping to control health care costs. Let me give you one example of that. In Anchorage, we have two hospitals primarily that treat the whole population, that's West Regional Hospital and Providence Hospital. We have been involved with negotiating contracts with those hospitals, and have solicited proposals on both a directed traffic basis, a series basis, as was referred to before, and on a task basis. The rates and the discounts that we've been offered on a series basis have been significantly better than those that were offered on a task basis. Senate Bill 299 would include hospitals as well as physicians and other providers, and that would eliminate the possibility of a hospital provider such as Alaska Regional Hospital or Providence Hospital from having a directed traffic type contract. I want to reiterate that the health plan does achieve some cost savings through those types of contracts. From a participant's point of view, the health plan does, they change the amount of their payment for healthcare services at a non-PPO provider compared to a PPO provider. If a participant, though, wants to go to a non-PPO provider, the health plan does provide some reimbursement, and the financial decision as to which provider to go to is the participant. I also wanted to address the issue of whether the AWP law would impact costs. We are not alone in that argument. In fact, a study that was published in the Journal of Health Economics in 2001 did find that health expenditures are higher when AWP laws are enacted. We're not alone in our opposition to AWP-type legislation. The National Association of Health Underwriters in 2003 identified one of the key components to the health insurance market stability as the ability of health plans to develop appropriate networks. They identified AWP legislation as a threat to market stability. And then finally, I wanted to point out that the Federal Trade Commission also opposes AWP legislation. I would direct your attention to a report that was put out by the FTC and the Department of Justice called Improving Healthcare Against Competition, which was published in July 2004. I encourage you to review the report. They noted that the AWP laws have anti-competitive effects, and it makes it less likely to obtain provider discounts, and it restricts the ability of health insurers or health plans to structure offerings with varying levels of choice. So it actually reduces the options available to employers. They also recognize the cost impact of AWP laws and how that affects consumers. The premium increases lead to employers forced to make really tough choices about limiting or dropping coverage for their employees. And they also suggest that AWP or freedom of choice laws are really intended to reduce competition between providers rather than protect the interests of the patient.
Right. So can you summarize, Colleen?
I would encourage you to consider our opposition to Senate Bill 295. And I also have one question as well, and that's our fiscal note, and what is your fiscal note on this bill? I note that State of Alaska Act plan does have preferred provider provisions for hospitals, and they projected cost savings by directing traffic to one hospital. So I'm curious as to how this would impact the State of Alaska costs.
Thank you. Are there questions for colleagues?
Just Mr. Chair, just Colleen, I'd appreciate it if you could provide to the committee the 2001, 2003, and 2004 reports that you referred to. That would be helpful for us.
Okay, thank you, Captain.
All right, thank you. We're going to try to get through the rest of this. Jack McCray, can you hear us, Jack?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Please give us your testimony.
I'll make it as precise and as short as possible. A lot has already been covered. Again, I'm Jack McCray, Senior Vice President for Blue Cross Field of Alaska. The couple aspects, we have about 50% of the physicians in Alaska on contract now, and we believe this saves our membership of their hundreds of thousands of dollars with the contracts we're able to negotiate with these physicians that we have to. There's two other aspects of the bill I'd like to talk about, and one is there's a misconception or a belief sometimes that if you're not with a contracted physician, you cannot go to a non-contracted physician, or you won't pay at that non-contracted physician. We do pay when someone goes to a non-contracted physician. It will be usually cost a member more money to go to that non-contracted physician, but we do pay. The other aspect I'd like to talk about for just a second is this continuity of care issue when a patient needs to go from one doctor to another doctor because of either moving in Alaska or because of the an issue with a contracted doctor. In 2000, the Alaska legislature addressed this issue by passing the Patient's Bill of Rights, which Blue Cross supported. And in that law, the patient will continue to be seen by the physician until treatment is completed, and Blue Cross will continue to pay the bills as before. For example, if a woman is pregnant, she will continue to see that physician through her pregnancy and through the postpartum care. So I know it's been discussed a couple times about the problem of going from one physician to another, and through your Patient's Bill of Rights in 2000, you pretty much have corrected that problem. I could go on and talk about the Federal Trade Commission study. One study we have from Arthur Anderson that was done through 98 to 2002 showed any willing provider would increase cost 12%. So I'm more than willing to answer any questions, but I try to truncate my testimony as much as I can due to time.
Other questions for Jack?
All right. Jack, I understand you're going to be, your firm's going to be more involved in the state care, employee care system. Is that correct?
Well, I am not deliberate to comment on that right now, but we hope so.
All right. Thank you. And thanks for helping us out today. Dr. Pfeiffer, can you hear us, sir?
Yes, I can't hear the name. Are you looking for me, Bill Pfeiffer?
Yes.
Okay. This is Dr. Bill Pfeiffer, representing the Alaska Chiropractic Society. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Seekin and the committee for bringing up a bill that I think is needed within the state. Any willing provider bill is a need. However, there are some language concerns within this bill that we have yet to have a chance to sit down with the sponsor of the bill and go through. Specifically, under line 12, 13 on page 1, and line 1 on page 2, seems to revert the intent of the legislation. It states the subsection does not affect different reimbursements, different types of health care providers, nor does it affect coverage for the services of a particular type of health care provider. So we would like to explore that further with the sponsor, try to get that either clarified or stricken out of this bill. The other concern is on page 2, line 9, under E, does not include insurance under data 2330 Alaska's Workers' Compensation Act. There may be some good rationale for that, but I, having sat on the Medical Services Review Committee for Workers' Compensation this last year, I had filed a minority report because the recommendation was to allow the insurance company or employer to choose the treating physician of an injured worker. That didn't go as any recommendation from the task force committee, but my concern is that language may have some other meaning in here, but I just like to clarify that for the sponsor. Then finally, the redefinition of healthcare provider raises some concern in that it includes facilities. And it's not that I think that hospitals and any other facilities listed should be protected under any willing provider bill. It's just that when you classify them as a provider, you take out the original language that exists now that says services within the scope of the provider's occupational license. And facilities don't have an occupation or a license, there's no reference back to that. And also, for example, an insurance company may contract with a hospital for x-rays, and in that it's considered a provider, may exclude small facilities with those capacities from providing it or having to be the same financial agreements that hospitals have, which has a broader base of absorbing reduction in cost. So with that, our society would hope that this bill doesn't get moved on and give us an opportunity to work with the sponsor. I think it's important to have this bill, but I think we need to try to work on some of the language before it moves on to the next committee.
Thank you. And we're not going to pass it out today, but almost on Dolly next week. Please work with the sponsor. Rose, any questions? Rose Calamandis in Anchorage, can you give us your testimony, Rose? Rose in Anchorage, can you hear us?
Can you hear me now?
What'd you say?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we got you, Rose. Go ahead.
Thank you. I don't have a testimony present today, although Greg and Colleen pretty well summed up the position of the Teamsters Trust Fund. So, our position is to oppose them.
All right. Thank you. We will
adjourn for today. We will take this up next week, and we'll get a schedule out. We'll see who's going to be here, and thank you for good work. Thank you all for helping us. We're adjourned.